Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage podcast episode, Having a Clue. Today, I'll be playing the part of Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And we have joining us from Cambridge, Mr.
Dan Sandler. Sorry, again, I keep missing my cue. I'm new to this whole podcasting thing. Dan Sandler, System UI team.
Dan is expecting that we have like tons and tons of guests here, and he was just one of many. But in fact, we only have Dan today. so today, I think today is a Hallmark episode in two respects. One is that we're doing this whole thing remotely. We're actually not sitting next to each other as we normally do.
Thank goodness.
Because Dan's out in Cambridge, and Tor didn't feel like commuting today.
Wait a second.
And the,
I think everybody
the
in California can be given a pass on not wanting to commute the day after like the most epic flooding to hit the state since
it was the apocalypse out here yesterday. No kidding, it actually rained and there was wind. Unbelievable.
At the same
I don't even
time.
Know how we're still alive. Yeah, yeah, scary. We are so afraid of weather out here that many cities, including San Francisco, actually closed school the day before the storm. They closed school on the rumor of a storm.
Yeah, my kids were super disappointed because our school district did not close schools, and they really felt gypped.
They should. They should. But when I was a kid, we used to walk to school through 6 inches of rain, but apparently not anymore.
Did you?
We had to go over the mountain barefoot, backwards both ways.
We had to go under the mountain, so, you know.
Ooh,
take that.
The Hall of the Mountain King. That would be exciting.
That's right. I have no memory of this place.
We have veered way, way off track. So the weird thing about this episode, besides the fact that we're trying to do this remotely, is that I actually have no idea what the topic is today. Dan said, hey, why don't we do a podcast where I'll pretend to be the interviewer? And I think what's actually going on, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, is that you're actually interviewing for guest host.
is that
in,
position?
In the eventual result that the network actually fires us, then they're going to have to replace it with somebody. So here you are.
Oh, I see. This is
your
like
guest host. You're replacing Johnny.
This is like a Letterman Leno thing. I see how it goes.
Yeah.
This is going to end badly for everyone.
Especially the listeners.
Maybe at the end, though. Maybe at the end, you can walk back on the podcast and sit down without a word and get like standing applause and then just walk out again.
We'll try that. We're going to need an applause track then.
We need a whole lot of Foley, right? Because this is also our holiday episode, right? Presumably we'll send this out sometime around the holidays. We need to Foley in, like, you know, jingle bells and other seasonally appropriate sound effects.
I'm loving that dreidel thing. We're just going to have that playing in the background
spinning
the entire time.
Actually, the sound of my MacBook fan, we can just pretend that's a dreidel spinning endlessly.
It's very joyous.
So
can you enlighten us what you actually wanted to talk about today?
Well, you guys have been on you in particular, Chet, but you guys have been on the lecture circuit for the last few months, essentially continuously since Lollipop shipped. I mean, you've been to what? You've been to DevOx and DevCon, the Orpheum, Radio City, Red Rocks. it's been like a tour, and I wanted to hear about that because I'm not aware of anybody else on the team that does. Certainly not on the engineering team. Obviously, DevRel, this is what they do, and they're professionals. You are obviously in no way mistaken for a professional. So I was just curious, you know.
Thank you.
How you, so first of all, how this whistle stop was.
It was good.
Well, what did you talk about? So what do people want to hear about on this besides process?
So there's a mix of talks that I like to give. Certainly at the end of the release, it's useful to have talks about what's new in Android. I love
that.
Submitting talks called What's New in Android, because when I submit it, I haven't a clue either what's new, what's going to be new, or what I'm actually going to talk
or
about.
Or what's
so
Android.
Really,
I mean, really, you're starting from nothing, which I think creates the best material.
Well, it's also a guaranteed way to pack the room.
Or people will realize that it's just a fluff talk and they'll go do something more interesting and informative instead.
I think you remember seeing the word keynote next to your name and not because of a typo. So people clearly, you know, are coming there for something special. Like that, exactly.
Believe.
That sound effect. That's what they're coming for.
I,
the predator.
I don't know where to go with that. So there was a few different things that I did. We a few of us went down to the big Android barbecue in Texas, and there was a keynote down there that we gave, which was essentially what's new in Android. The timing was actually perfect because we had just announced Lollipop the day before or that day. The timing of the actual release coming out and us doing a keynote about what was new was couldn't have been better. We told the people at the barbecue that it was because of them that we were, you know, saving it for that special moment. And I haven't a clue if they actually believed us, but that would be nice.
You can't fool the Texans, so they probably saw right through it. But I think they appreciated it all the same that essentially it was breaking news at BA Barbecue.
Yeah. Especially since, I mean, this was not a DevOps. This was not a 4,000-person event. This was a couple hundred people in the room. All very, very enthusiastic. It's an interesting mix at a conference. Like normally I go to developer conferences where everybody is an Android developer or developer of some sort. And at the barbecue, it's a strange mix of developers as well as just users. There were people saying, you know, I'd like to start developing. But then I wasn't quite sure why they were at my Android performance talk. I hope it was interesting, but I'm not sure it really applied to their lives. But anyway, so there was a mix of talks there. There was the What's New keynote as well as performance talks, and somehow a comedy talk slipped in there somewhere. And then I went over to London and gave some talks. There was a keynote at DroidCon, again, a What's New thing going on there, as well as another technical session. And then at DevOx, same kind of thing. There was a keynote that I gave with Nick Butcher where we talked about material design. That was kind of nice as a keynote for DevOx. DevOx is mainly Java developers and enterprise and back-end server developers, but they also cover other technologies. The nice thing about material design is we talked about not just Android. I could give a lot more details on Android, but material design applies across different platforms. So we also talked about Polymer instances, how the material design...
Now, did they know,
shall we say, paradigm?
Did they know that you would have this whole new design language to come talk about, or did they essentially say, Nick and Chet, why don't you come on down, basically talk about whatever you want? Like, how did that?
Kind of. There was going to be a Google keynote, and in the few weeks leading up to it, we decided what that keynote would entail.
Okay.
And we had done stuff around Android or specific technologies in the past, and we thought it would scale better to talk about something that spanned Google technologies and spanned ideas instead and sort of took a step back.
So they knew that you guys had something good to talk about just, you know, because you always do, but they didn't know specifically that they were going to get hit with the baseball bat of material at that time.
No, we published it beforehand, like that there would be a material design talk. So at least for a couple of weeks, they knew what the keynote was.
Yeah, there was a little bit of lag because you were out of town, out of the country, whatever, for like a month solid doing these appearances.
Out of my mind.
Out of your mind. That's right.
Yeah,
that's a more ongoing problem, but travel wise,
it was particularly the case when I was in Europe. Actually, all the business stuff went really well. I spent some time in the London office talking with folks there, doing the DroidCon conference, and then the DevOx talks went pretty well. In the meantime, my body was falling apart. I never recovered from jet lag. I actually passed out in the middle of the National Theatre in London. It was pretty awesome. So as far as trips go, it sucked, but the business side was good. There was some question that got pushed on the stack that I can't remember.
Well, I got a couple that I've got queued up. The comedy sessions. This is now I've heard you've done this a couple times now since I believe the one at I/O this year was the first time that you had done a comedy like a pure that speechless style comedy session at a conference. Is that right, or is there precedent for this that I'm not
aware? Well, no, he did it a couple of years ago, as I recall.
Did you?
Well, no, there's two kinds of comedy talks that I have somehow strangely been pulled into. One is the satire talks that I have done for 3 years
now. Yeah, your business process business.
Yeah. But that's separate than the speechless thing. The speechless thing was new. I had personally done that because it came from a comedy show that's in the city.
The city for our listeners is San Francisco.
It is indeed. But we had not done that at a conference. I've been working with these guys sort of hoping we could do something like this because I think something like speechless applies really well at a conference where everybody's doing presentations anyway. But we winged it and tried that for the first time at Google I/O, and then we did another version of it at the Android barbecue as well.
And the other comedy talks were just the business, the water world flow development. I'm trying to remember now. I keep getting your talks mixed up with actual business process.
I think the audience does too. I see some very confused faces, especially since the way I like to give the satire talks is just completely deadpan in the character of the idiot who's presenting, which means that if you're not expecting a comedy talk, you spend a couple of minutes realizing that either it's a comedy talk or I'm just an idiot. So there are some people that actually come to the talk thinking, oh, gee, this title looks like it'll teach me a lot about process because it says the word process 7 times in the title. And then they show up and realize they're not going to learn a thing.
So I'm thinking. I'm thinking a winning strategy is then if you want to go to one of these conferences, right? If you want to get your boss to pay for you to go to one of these conferences, all you have to do is take the précis of the Chet Haas talk and say, "Look at this. This is going to teach us all kinds of process. I'm going to come back with amazing new ideas. We're going to come back with like 48 Sigma. It's going to blow our waterfall out of the water." And then people
that works right up until the point where the conference publishes it on YouTube, and then the boss actually sees what they wasted their time going to see.
But that by that point, the expense report's already paid out.
True, true.
So you know,
and the odds of them actually checking out the video, I would say, it's pretty low.
What?
I mean, the boss, not the engineers, but the boss.
Everyone's watching these, aren't they?
That's right. Judging by the comments, literally everyone.
Do you have metrics?
You know, that's a good question. Do you have metrics?
The metrics that I have are, let's see, what one of these. So the patterns talk, I think, was the most viewed talk of DevOx 2013 on the Parlay site. So that was good. And then the process talk that I gave the year before that was the highest rated talk. So, and I don't know about this year's because the metrics aren't out yet. But what it tells me is that people go to conferences to learn, but what they actually do there is they just want to see comedy. So I'd like to help them out.
That's great. Well, so is that, I mean, so you've done this a lot, right? You've done this a lot as part of your work here at Android. You did a ton of speaking of this sort, you know, before even coming to Google. How did this become part of your, your professional identity? How did you get into this in the first place?
I think I realized early on that I wasn't actually good enough at writing code, that I needed to find another skill to sort of make myself useful to the corporations that hire me. I started giving talks when I was at Sun years ago. We had the Java 1 conference every year. So I gave some of those talks and then talked at user groups. And then I realized, I think it took me back to piano recitals and that sort of feeling of fear and adrenaline that you get on stage and somehow becomes addictive. So I realized that I enjoyed giving talks at that point, and when you give more of them, you get more practiced, it gets a little less scary and a little more comfortable. I was at Adobe and was doing similar things there. I also started doing some videos, short video tutorials there, and that's a pretty good format that I've started using. I realized that I really enjoy writing, but it can take me a day or two to write a good solid article around a demo, whereas I can record that in 5 minutes. So it's a very efficient mechanism for getting some information out there, and I enjoyed getting up in front of the camera too.
And Adobe used that for ads, right? I swear I've been on web pages where suddenly there's like an auto roll, and then there's like Chet in a black shirt talking to me from the sidebar about Flex.
Yeah, there was a one-off that they did, I think, when Flex 4 came out.
Like, I was not visiting Flex sites, so this was like an ad.
And it says, punch the monkey right at the bottom.
Yeah, there was an ad for Flex that hit several developer sites at the time. There was me and some of the other developers on the Flex team that did that one. That was a weird one. Mostly I do technical stuff. But anyway, so I got to Google and just kept pushing on that because, you know, it's fun. I personally find it enjoyable to do, to actually work on the technology and then go out and hopefully teach people how to use it. I think it's also useful for developers to hear from someone on the team that's working closer with the technology, you know, what the tips and the tricks are. I believe that actually working on the technology gives me some amount of credibility. So it's not like, you never know when you walk into a room and someone's presenting whether they're just trying to give you a pitch. Is this a sales pitch? Is this some marketing spin on the technology? Are they going to try to get me to use their platform for some business reason? And I think it's clearer when there's actually an engineer on the stage that they're just talking about the technology that they love. You can take it for what it's worth, but they're trying to teach you about how to use the thing. There's not a lot of marketing spin involved. Right, so I enjoy it from that standpoint because I think that's an important element of these tech conferences.
I found when I was in grad school, you start out giving presentations about stuff that other people have done, and so you have to study up on it, and you get to a place where you're sort of confident enough to get up there and stand there and talk about it, but really it doesn't come from the same place that it does when you talk about your own work. Not only can you speak more confidently about it, because I mean, presumably you're the world's expert on your own stuff. But then you know you can extemporize, right? People have questions. You can answer from the guts of it. You can reach into your own memory and understanding and answer it as close to from first principles as possible. So I think what you're saying about developers feeling like there's credibility there. I mean, I think there's a ton of credibility coming from, for example, people who just do DevRel, because they also go in and they learn it and they write code with it, they write samples, they find bugs. Oh God, they find so many bugs and for us to fix. And so it's great to hear DevRel speak about it because they know about, they've seen it from the eyes of the developer who's trying to use it. Here's where the gotchas are. Here's what you maybe don't know. You should maybe just use Android Studio because that it's just going to work better. I'm just flashing back to some Gradle issues I was having earlier in the week. But you know, what the actual developer getting up there and speaking brings to it is this person actually built it, and so they can tell you something like, "Well, I thought about doing it that way, but in the end, we decided not to, and here's why." And that's something that maybe you hadn't even really articulated to anybody until that moment on stage. And I think that's one of the things. You know, Chet, when you're speaking, when you're on the docket, you know, that's what people show up for is, oh, he's going to be able to tell us something that nobody has ever written down before about this
component. And hopefully add a joke at the end.
And thank goodness, because otherwise it would be so boring.
I think that is one of the elements that I really enjoy about speaking, in particular, I hate to use the word style because that sounds a little too planned, but what I really enjoy doing is getting up on stage with someone else, like I did with you, Dan, at Google I.O. this year and a couple of years ago. One of the elements that I find really fun is that I have no idea what we're going to say. We haven't scripted anything out. We just know the content on the slides and we know the background of that content. But that means that when we're in the middle of a topic and I remember a use case that came up or a problem that I hit, then it's easy to just say at that point, oh, by the way, here's something that's interesting about this particular API or a performance gotcha or whatever.
And it is a particular style, right? I mean, we're not going to, using that approach, it's fun for us. It requires less preparation, which for lazy people like you and me is a plus. But we're not going to, it's not going to have the same kind of, you know, inspirational effect as like a TED Talk where, you know, every microsecond is deeply rehearsed so that by the end of that, you know, 2.5 minute speech or whatever, people are like, you know, shouting and jumping out of their seats, right? Like that's never going to happen from an extemporized, you know, what's new in Android kind of talk. But I think what we do get out of it is that sort of, unpredictable, natural sort of quality that allows people to sort of like plug in and say, oh, you know, I see where this is coming from, right? I believe that these people know what they're talking about.
Right. That's certainly my hope. Yeah, my petty rationalization is that it takes less time for me to prepare the talks. My hope is that it's a more engaging presentation than it would be otherwise because it's a conversation, right? It's a real conversation that I, you, us, we are having with the audience as opposed to this, you know, carefully scripted and, you know, wordsmith thing that we're throwing at them.
So I was offhanded that I was having Gradle issues this week, and then I fired up what I was trying to do, which coincidentally was a watch face sample, thanks to the new massive Android Wear software upgrade this week. And Tor said, hey, you should try it in Android Studio because we have a, what is it, 1.0, and it works like a charm there. And lo and behold, it did. So Tor, why don't you tell us about Android Studio 1.0? We can think of it as a sponsor. Our sponsor this week is Android Studio.
1.0? You mean Alpha 1.0?
No, one.
Or is this a beta release?
No, we had our final first 1.0 release this week on Monday. Yeah, after several years of development. And, you know, we went into beta for Google I.O. in June. And then we've had, you know, release candidates the last month or so. And yeah, this week, 1.0. And in fact, we're probably pushing out 1.0.1. this morning with a few, you know, last minute bug fixes.
Wait. So you actually have overflow? Does it bounce or like wrap around? Shouldn't it be like 0.99?
Well, we decided to use floating point for our version number.
What is the exact interpolator on these version numbers? I need to know.
we actually use IntelliJ's versioning scheme, so it's major dot minor dot micro. So we're putting out a few bug fixes for the AVD manager in particular, and Windows in particular. So one that all went out, and
exciting for us. People who've been playing the home game, people who've been playing along at home, what would be new in 1.0? If people have been using some of the release candidates, like they installed NetIO, maybe they took a couple of updates, like what are they going to see besides, I think, a new icon dropped in the last few weeks? What are they going to see that's like, oh man, this is 1.0 now?
Well, what we've done since about September, when we went into feature freeze, is fixing critical bugs and stabilizing the Gradle API. So I think the most painful part for people using Android Studio has been that every time they update, they can't sync their project because we changed something in the Gradle plugin, and now you have to change the version number and change the Gradle version and all that stuff. And so now that we've reached 1.0, we've done it again. we've sort of
done it again. That should be the tagline for Android Studio. Android Studio 1.0, we've done it again.
Yes, I'll talk to marketing about that. It'll help boost sales, I'm sure. So, for 1.0, we basically ripped out all the deprecated stuff and finally said, okay, this is something we can support going forward. So now that we're at 1.0, we won't do that for every update, right? So if in the future we discover that we, for some reason, have to change something, let's say Gradle version 3 comes out and we discover that we have to make an API change, then we'll also build tooling to help you do that completely automatically. We're not going to say, hey, you need to go and edit these 7 files to make it work again.
As somebody who feels like his the apotheosis of build systems is a file that requires tabs and not spaces, can you explain what exactly is happening here? Like resyncing your project, upgrading the Gradle, what exactly has come apart there that then needs to be thatched together and that Android Studio is helping you do?
Well, so we have these behind the scenes. We're using Gradle, and I mean, we're hoping that you don't even have to know that, right? You create a new project, it just builds. If you want to edit your project structure, you open the project structure dialog, which is sort of the same thing you have in IntelliJ, where you can go and choose what compile SDK version you want and all that stuff. And when you hit OK, it should just save that somewhere. And you shouldn't have to know that behind the scenes, it's actually putting it in a Gradle file, which is really a Groovy file, but using the specific build domain-specific language. That Gradle is basically providing us. So we're using Gradle behind the scenes. And for most users, hopefully they don't have to know that. But if you have complicated requirements, it lets you go in and do a lot of advanced things. And so it's a build system that's very, very extensible. So to take just one example, let's say you want to have an about box in your app where you're showing which version this app was built from. And you really want that not to be this number that you're updating. You want it to be your actual Git revision number. It's very, very easy to go and say, my version code is, and then you just put like a method call, and that method call just calls git dot, now I can't remember the actual Git syntax for looking up the current revision, right? But there's a Git command for that. And so it just takes that string and makes that the version code, and when you build your app, it'll use that. So that's
It'll dynamically generate like a strings.xml that is the result of some command.
The actual, it used to be that in your manifest, you have a version name and version code. Right? Mm-hmm,
yep.
You can make your version name the string that literally goes in the manifest file. Well, in the Gradle build system, we actually create a merged manifest. We sort of take all the manifests from all the libraries and we merge them together using a specific algorithm. So for example, if you're using a library that needs permission X, or let's say location permission, right? Then that means that your app would need it too. So before the Gradle build system, all of our tutorials would say, hey, here's our location tutorial. First, go and put this permission in your manifest. Then go copy this activity into your project, right? We've gone away from that now. So as soon as you use a library, all the permissions specified by that library automatically get added into your app as well. So that manifest merge is what is also combined with Gradle, so that if your Gradle file says, my version code is going to be this, that gets compiled into your APK.
That's excellent. Okay, yeah. So that sounds really useful.
Oh, there's a huge set of really useful features in Gradle now. My personal favorite, and that's just because I worked on it, you know, is resource shrinking, right? Where, you know, you can go right now and remove unused resources in your app. But if you're using a library, you don't have the luxury. I mean, that's coming from the third party, and you can't take these resources out. And to the person who made the library, those resources are not unused. They're used by some portion of the library. But let's say you're using just a small portion of the library. So for example, Play Services is a big library, right? And let's say I'm using ads from that library. Hmm. Well, if I compile my app, I'm now getting like the Google Plus sign-in button resource added into my app because, you know, it's part of that library and it's not unused. If I actually had called the Google Plus sign-in, I would need that asset. So what this resource shrinking does is it basically, you know, takes the program output, figures out what is the remaining code that you've used from this library and what are the resources reachable from that remaining code, and it rips everything else out. That's just a small example. And I should just, to be fair, Play Services released a new version this week where they actually have broken Play Services into smaller portions. So actually you can just pick and choose now which Play Service library you want, which helps a lot with the 65K method limit problem.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. So anyway, for Android Studio, we based that on IntelliJ 13. And of course, right around the time we shipped Android Studio 1.0, IntelliJ shipped version 14. So our next task now is to go and upgrade our code base for our upcoming release to IntelliJ 14, which has lots of new cool features.
Like a new version of Gradle that you'll have to break everything to upgrade to?
No, the Gradle support is really something that we're driving. IntelliJ, they have their own non-Gradle-based project model, right, that they've honed over the years. And so our experience from working on the Eclipse plugin was, you know, we didn't want to have one build system for the IDE and one for the command line. So we had like an Ant-based command line build system and another one for Eclipse. They were totally separate implementations. And over time, they weren't exactly compatible, right? But so you had to sort of, you know, build the project in the IDE. And then on the command line, when you wanted to build it on the build server, you used this other build system that sometimes behaved differently. And that was very, very unfortunate. So one of our key requirements was we wanted to have a build system that is the same in the IDE as on the command line. And so we've really sort of, in Android Studio, you can only create Gradle-based projects. We don't support the IntelliJ-based projects or, you know, Eclipse-based projects. It's all Gradle all the way. And that's not something IntelliJ does. They have support for Gradle, but I think their default mode for Gradle projects is to sort of to import it and then treat it as an IntelliJ project.
That's actually really useful because I have gotten into a situation, even with markers with my app that where I'm compiling and running through the IDE, and the APK is built one way, and then you know I go and you know Ant release and it builds it a different way, and there's some subtle difference in even just where the APK is dropped, so I end up pulling the wrong one just because you know the two completely separate build systems. So having exactly one way to build your APK that is super useful.
Yeah, and it's very challenging because IDEs, you know, tend to be sort of control freaks. They want to know absolutely exactly what the dependencies are and which file affects what and do that. And that's
I can't imagine why that might be.
Yeah. And that is tied to features like compile on save, which, you know, Eclipse users loved and IntelliJ users love. And we don't actually have that because sort of using Gradle, we can't do that very easily. And I think it's something we'll look at. Definitely the compile times have gotten worse. So, you know, these features do have a cost, but that's something that, you know, we have a lot of people working on is attacking the build speed problem from many different angles.
So where do people go to get the awesome new Android Studio 1.0? We did it again.
Well, now we finally have updated developer.android.com. So, you know, until now, if you went to the official Android site, developer.android.com, you know, Eclipse was still listed as the stable release, and then we had some links for like a preview version of Android Studio, which was basically always out of date because we released new canaries every week. But now, developer.android.com points to our Android Studio 1.0. But I'm sure if you just search for Android Studio, you'll be pointed to it. And if you're using an older version of Android Studio, you know, you can just do check for updates, and it'll also give you a download link to it.
I also really like the move. This happened when everything was in Eclipse as well, but the bundles help a lot. Like it was a bit painful, 3 or 4 years ago when you'd need to get this and then you need to get that and then you need to run this tool to update this. And it's like everything was disjoint as opposed to now you get this one blob.
Yeah, well, to be fair, we actually did add an Eclipse bundle 2 years ago, I think, where we took Eclipse plus the SDK. That's still not quite enough. And so even though I said we were feature frozen in September, we did two other things after that we sort of like exempted from the feature freeze. And one of them was a full-blown Windows installer, which helps you, you know, also install the JDK. It helps make sure that, you know, you get Haxam installed. And if you don't know, Haxam is this native accelerator, which makes the emulator tolerable on x86, right? So it makes the emulator much faster. And if you don't have it, the emulator is going to be super, super slow. And Haxam makes it really fast. So the installer makes sure you have it and actually runs, delegates to the Haxam installer to make sure that's run. It also sets up an AVD for you. And it makes sure that you put, you know, the SDK in a place where you have write access. There's like a bunch of things that it does to get things set up correctly, because there's so many places that things can go wrong in just the initial setup. It's not really obvious, right, to you that, you know, you need to have a version of Java installed to run an IDE. I mean, if you're not familiar with IDEs, you might not know that. So it goes through all that. And the other thing we did was we made a setup wizard. So the installer I mentioned is for Windows only. We made a DMG, so you can sort of drag to install on Mac. But on Mac and Linux, we have this setup wizard, which sort of does something similar to the installer. If it sees that you're a first-time user or you haven't run the setup wizard before, it pops up before the IDE starts, this wizard, which also makes sure you have Haxam, which also checks that your SDK installation has the latest, and if not, like lets you go and install it. So we've done a bunch of work to try to optimize the flow to getting all the pieces you need, you know, virtual devices for the emulator, Haxam, all that stuff, set up correctly right from the get-go.
I just ran into that myself this past week, and it worked like a charm, although I was surprised because in order to install Haxam, I assume there's some kexts in there or something like that. It required root. And so there was a little dialog box that said, OSA script wants your root password. I said, what?
Yeah, I know. But we've gotten a lot of feedback on that. So, you know, the only way that we know, we think, if you have some code you need to run and you want to run it with, you know, root privileges, you know, you have to run this AppleScript command to say, hey, run this command for me and ask the user for root password first. And that's, you know, you obviously don't get to set the label of that text box. It would be helpful if it could, saying, hey, Android Studio needs to install Haxam. But, you know, if that feature was there, malicious people could say, you know, run this root dialog and call it, you know, Mac OS X security update, right? And then people will just click on it. So I can see why they sort of don't want to let you customize that password dialog. But yeah, it's a bit confusing. And so I think, you know, in an update, we'll make sure that before we run it, we'll say, we're now going to run Haxam. You know, it's going to come up with this dialogue. If you feel more safe doing it yourself, you can just cancel out of it and then instead go and download this, you know, installer directly from Intel and run that yourself.
Because that's really a lot of words for the title of a dialogue box.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't
imagine what it's going to look like in German. It's just going to go off the screen.
Yeah. Yeah. We've unfortunately not localized IDE. So it's English everywhere. One day we'll try to fix it. So the setup wizard, we're hoping will solve a lot of the setup problems people have had that just sort of lead to a lot of problems down the road.
There was a problem that I used to have, my perennial problem with Eclipse back when I was using Eclipse and ADT, was that all of the disjoint pieces would sort of get on a different install train where I would run it and it would say your SDK is out of date and I would update that, but that was out of date with the ADT plugin version, and all of these things were sort of separate pieces in the IDE that you had to sort of know the tricks to say, oh, update my plugin, and then within the plugin run the SDK manager, update the SDK, and
I think that would make a really good mobile game, like Software Install Story. Right? Like the whole game is just you have to keep the versions of all of your different applications.
Oh, and then one of the levels is how fast can you click on the EULA to make it go away?
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah. Free ideas.
And then it'll actually test you later to see if you read it.
Ooh,
that's the expert level to finish the game. You know, you have to be able to recite some of the stuff.
Yeah. Answer a quiz on some, you know, like buried text halfway through.
But
yeah.
This is actually a problem we have now. So it used to be when we had the build system part of the Eclipse plugin, right? You saw, you know, that we updated the Eclipse plugin and there was this feature you wanted, so you updated. But it turns out now you also got a new version of our Eclipse builder, and that changed things. And suddenly your build didn't work anymore. Right. And so one of the things we've done is we really decoupled the build tools from the tools. Right. So now there's a bunch of different versions. There's the platform tools. That's where you get ADB. Right. ADB and AAPT are really tied to the version of Android that you've installed. And then we have the tools themselves, which is like the IDE, and you pretty much always want the latest and greatest there. But then you may want to get the latest tools without actually changing your builds. You know, you're about to release, and so you don't dare to actually touch anything, like any dependencies, any libraries. And so with Gradle, it's very easy for us to sort of spec out exactly which revision you have. You know, so with Eclipse, it was sort of like, you know, you would copy in the source code into your project, but there wasn't a specific version number, and it was hard to know which version of ActionBar Sherlock do you have copied into your workspace. Now you basically have very specific versions saying, I'm using version, you know, 4.2 of the JSON library or whatever. And so on top of your dependencies, the build tools themselves are kind of like a library. So you get to say, I'm using build tools 21.1. And you can get the new version of the IDE without actually changing the build tools you're using, or vice versa. You know, so you can sort of you can update those independently, which is kind of an important feature. But also, it does have this confusion that Chet just mentioned, that hey, you know, you're updating all these things independently. One thing we think makes it a little bit easier is that A, we have the IDE telling you when your build tools are out of date, so it'll say, hey, you know, you probably should get the latest version of the build tools here. And then there's like a quick fix to click a button, and it actually walks you to the installer and installs it for you. So we hope that's going to give people more trust, I guess, in updating the IDE, is that they can update the IDE without actually affecting their builds until they're ready to do that. Now, that hasn't been true during the preview stage of Android Studio, but now that we've reached 1.0, we really are hoping to stay much more compatible with the build tools.
I think you want to make it a little bit painful during a beta period, because otherwise people don't actually believe you that it's beta software.
we haven't had the devaluation of the word beta.
Yeah, we haven't had that problem.
I was also wondering, with the quick fixes, like there are so many quick fixes in there, often I'll look at, you know, some warning or error, and I don't know what to do about it, and then I realize there's a quick fix that I can just apply and it magically works. Have you considered adding a cartoon character pop-up to the quick fixes so that they could just come up and helpfully, you know, say that they want to help you?
Should it look like a paperclip and be called Linty?
Yeah, it looks like you're trying to rewrite list view.
Well, there's a feature we've added pretty recently. You know, so when you hover over a warning in IntelliJ, you sort of get a one-line error message. And it's the same error message that Lint would print out, you know, from the command line. But it's very difficult to explain some issues in one line. You know, sometimes it's kind of subtle. It's like, well, if you do this and this and this, then you also have to do this, right? And so all Lint issues have actually had multiple paragraphs of explanation associated with them too. And when you run Lint and you ask it to export an HTML report, you actually get that full explanation that comes with the error warning. And it turns out that IntelliJ had this feature where some of their warnings, if you press Command F1 or Control F1, I guess, on Windows or Linux, it would actually then inline change the whole error message to a multi-line tooltip that showed the whole explanation. And so we hooked that up. So now, for a lot of these warnings, you can actually get more information right inline if you want to. Now, if you just want to apply the quick fix, by all means. But often there are a lot of complicated issues we don't have a quick fix for, like the overdraw. Right? Overdraw is a typical example. It looks at your theme, it looks at your activity, tries to figure out, is this a theme that paints stuff? Does your layout actually do stuff on top? We can't auto-fix that. We can just tell you that it looks like, you know, in this layout, you probably have overdraw because it looks like you're painting your own background in the layout and the theme probably does the same thing, right? And that's one of those things where the explanation is going to help you and the quick fix won't. And I guess that's one thing I would encourage all the people who are trying Android Studio from Eclipse should try, is to basically run analyze, inspect code. There's a lot more inspections in IntelliJ and Android Studio than we had in Eclipse. And so I think it identifies a lot of interesting things in your code that you should just basically take a look at. And then for a lot of them, there's quick fixes as well.
It's like having a free code reviewer at your shoulder. Like, it's just another pair of eyes. I've found... Chet proposed a little cartoon that would pop up along with these assistants. I've found the cartoon image, so we're going to have to put this on the website in the show notes so that everybody else can see. That's the that's my proposal. Take it or leave it.
It works for me.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. Sounds good. I smell an Easter egg.
I hope not. Those don't smell very good after a while.
Speaking of Easter eggs, hey, Dan, tell me about Lollipop.
What's to tell? So, well, I mean, we talked a little bit, I think, about the Easter eggs on the the previous episode that I was on. And so this one was no different. We sort of dug up some code that we had moldering around somewhere and dusted it off. Actually, the Easter egg, which is known in the code as Lollipop Land, started life toward the beginning of the year, actually, when all the real-time shadow casting stuff was pretty new in the platform. And I said, well, I wonder just how many things I can have casting shadows on each other at the same time. And so I put this together as a demo. It was sort of the geometric abstraction of the flappy bird concept, with the player was a square and the obstacles were rectangles and the buildings in the background were rectangles and the sun was a rectangle. And they were all casting shadows on each other. And I generated tons and tons of bugs where things were at higher elevations but drawing underneath each other and all kinds of stuff like that. So it was a useful sort of stress test. I remember Chris Craig and John Reck being thankful / you know, regretful that this thing existed so that they could test out that stuff. It was also an early test of how all that stuff looked on Android TV, right? Because at that time Android TV was not released. I was actually out visiting California and working late one night. I was like, I got to try this on the TV, but I didn't have one handy. Fortunately, since I was in the California office, there were plenty of them, you know, sitting around. And so I just sort of wandered over to a nearby one and installed this. And I was like, oh, yeah, it works pretty well. And of course, I left it running. So in the morning, when Tim Kilburn came in, he was like, who has been using my top secret device? And why is it a game? And why can I not stop playing it? And so just to wrap it up for the final release, I went and took, we've got all these great new material icons and assets that are all in the great new vector drawable format, which is very similar to SVG, as people know. And so I was able to just pull those right in there and have sort of pre-made artwork, sparing everybody my own artwork on the topic. So, you know, as usual, we did the laziest thing that could possibly work, which is dig up some old sample code, dust it off, and, you know, the rest is history.
I like raising the bar, although that doesn't apply since all the bars are actually vertical in the game. But I like raising the bar to actually make it a game. So previously, the Easter eggs have been sort of graphically interesting, you know, moving, but not terribly complex things.
No, spiritually sudden, moving, but not literally moving.
Yes. Now you gave people a way to waste a hell of a lot of time there. Will you answer the great mystery question about the game, which is, so I've seen several images posted online of people saying, hey, and then I encountered this lollipop stick with no hole in it.
There's actually a public bug, I think there's a public bug in the Android tracker about that. Yeah, it's
working.
It's
intended.
Actually, it's a philosophical statement on the futility of life. Intentionally. No, it's a bug. It's a bug.
Is it?
It is. It is a bug.
I just figured it was Dan's little joke. And I haven't actually encountered it myself because I think my high score is 1.
There you go. So. No, that's good. That's good. 1 is good. No, the physics are actually a little different from other flappy games you may have played. So I'll leave it as an exercise to the reader, specifically the reader of the source code, to figure out how best to play it in its shipping form. Obviously, people have now taken the code and modified it and, you know, given themselves maxant scores and what have you.
So speaking of source code, when you do these Easter eggs, do you hide them in the source code in any way, or do you just check it in?
So I'm glad you asked that, because I actually feel pretty strongly about that. They're hidden from the user because they're supposed to be something delightful that you discover if you know the trick. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, I'd flip through my, you know, paper copy of Macworld or Mac User or whatever, looking for, you know, what thing to hold down command and option when you clicked on to get something cool. So we don't have those paper magazines anymore, but, you know, you go on Android Police or what have you. So it's supposed to be hidden from the user, the casual user, but it's definitely not supposed to be hidden from the source code. There's nothing up our sleeve at Android for those that wish to seek it. The source code is out there for anybody to read and understand. You know, file bugs on, or at least, you know, understand how that is interacting with their code. So we've got no secrets from people reading AOSP. Now, if you are asking about whether it's kept secret from the rest of the team or not, yes, I have to hold those back in a private Git repository until very, very close to the end, because sometimes it, well, I mean, you know, I don't want to ruin the surprise.
Well, many years ago in a different company, we put an Easter egg in a piece of software, And it was hidden in the source code, and you know, in Java, it's pretty easy to do that in a really sneaky way, right? It turns out that you can use the Unicode escape characters, you know, backslash U. And if you do the backslash U stuff, the Java compiler will treat it as the actual character that you're referencing, but IDEs will not. So if you start, if you write a comment, you start it with a slash star, but in the comment you do backslash U to actually end the comment. All IDEs will continue to highlight this as a comment, but the compiler is back out of the comment and now interpreting your code. So you can sort of like say, hey, here's some commented out test code, you know, leave it in place because, you know, we might find this useful in the future. And then actually it's code that runs, right? You know, you put a static in there so that, you know, at load time it does whatever.
That's so sketchy.
Yeah, so you can do that. And so anyway, the reason I'm bringing this up is that in Lint, actually Lint has an Easter egg detector which looks for this pattern. It looks for the backslash U stuff. It's off by default, but if you're worried that, you know, you have some sketchy coworkers, you know, you can actually try to enable that, the Easter egg detector in Lint, and run it in your source base and find out if you actually have this. Yeah.
I love how Lint is fighting the last war there.
That's right.
Like, somebody once tried to slip something in this way, so we'll look for that specific exploit.
Well, the one person did it was me, right? So, you know, I wrote a Lint check to detect so no one else gets to do it. I did it. I got away with it. You know. I think this actually is documented. I didn't think of that Easter egg myself. I read it somewhere. I think it was, might have been Peter van der Linden, I think, maybe his Just Java book. I'm not sure. It's been a long time.
Reflections on Trusting Trust. Yeah, no, it's important to me that the code in Android, for those that are reading through it, be very clear. Everything is very obvious. Well, as obvious as we can make it. Certainly there are some things that are hard to understand, but that's not intentional obfuscation. That's just, you know what? It's hard to write a window manager.
All right.
So on that note, should we have we been going for about 2.5 hours now?
And it doesn't feel a minute over two.
Do you think people listen to us at 1x? Do you think we rate that? Or are we like a 1.5x podcast?
What did Kirill say this week, that we all sound the same at 2x? which is why we speak at half speed, because we know that he's just doubling it anyway.
We're slowing this down for you, Kirill.
Well, thanks for joining us. Thanks for hosting us. Thanks for having us on your podcast.
I was simply a fly on the wall, nothing more.